Good morning, everyone. This is Forrest Kayser at the CPUC. Welcome to the second webinar of the Integrated Resource Planning Modeling Advisory Group. Everyone is in listen-only mode for now. We will have Q&A periodically throughout this webinar. We're going to start off with just a few background slides on the Modeling Advisory Group before we dive into today's main content, which will be presented by Nick Schlag from E3. The presentation materials are all available on the CPUC's IRP Events and Materials webpage. And this webinar is being recorded. And so we'll try to use slide numbers to refer to slides as we talk through, because we're just recording the audio. So I'm going to move on to slide number two, which says the Modeling Advisory Group background at the top. And so this is just a little background on the Modeling Advisory Group. The Energy Division staff is currently in the midst of working on developing a staff proposal for implementing IRP here at the PUC in 2017. And one core component of the proposal that staff is working on is the development of a reference 40% by 2030 plan that's going to inform the development of the individual LSE plans. And in some of the materials, you'll see it referred to as a reference system plan. We've asked for some feedback on naming, so that may change, but I'm hopeful that everyone understands the core plan that we're talking about there. So the Modeling Advisory Group is specifically formed to increase transparency and provide the opportunity for members of the public and parties to provide feedback as we develop the proposal. So we've had an online survey after our first webinar to collect information and responses from parties, and one of the requests involved trying to better understand all the different workflows that were originally described in a concept paper that staff released. And so the next slide tries to put some of this work into a bigger context. So what you see here on the left-hand side are several boxes representing different spheres of work that Energy Division staff is currently engaged in. So the four boxes on the far left are the ones that will immediately feed into a workshop in the near future. And this Modeling Advisory Group is one of those four boxes. In parallel, we're also having webinar series on scenario development. We also expect to be releasing written documentation of assumptions that we're planning to use, including sources and values, as well as a proposal for the greenhouse gas-related assumptions in particular. And we're expecting all of these different webinar series and staff documents to converge in the form of a workshop in the near future. Now, that workshop will also eventually lead to the development of a broader staff proposal, and other Energy Division work activities will feed into that proposal as well, and those are indicated by the boxes describing LSE IRP requirements, LSE IRP review, and procurement guidance. So when the IRP staff proposal comes together, the vision here is that it would be released into entered into the record of the proceeding, of the IRP proceeding, at which point parties will have the opportunity to provide formal party comments. So prior to entering that staff proposal onto the record, we're working on an informal basis to collect feedback and sort of craft the best staff proposal that we can. But there will be opportunity for entering comments on the record once the proposal is released. So then after the staff proposal for the overall approach to IRP is released, that's the point where we would actually initiate model runs. And the Modeling Advisory Group will have a chance to reflect on those model runs and provide feedback on those model runs and inform the proposal that comes from staff, a second staff proposal that comes from staff, on the specific recommendations for which plan to consider to provide guidance to the individual LSEs. So once that staff proposal is developed, it again would be entered into the record of the proceeding, and parties would have the chance to comment again on that reference plan. And then that would lead to the development of a proposed decision, including the reference plan as well as the other components that are listed in the bottom right-hand corner of this slide. So I hope that provided some context into around how the modeling advisory group is intended to relate to the other kinds of activities the Energy Division staff is currently engaged in, and how it relates to the activities that are taking place formally within the proceeding as laid out in the scoping memo. You know, I think at this point we're going to switch gears a little bit. We'll have a chance for a Q&A before we move into E3's presentation, but I want to turn it over to Patrick Young to talk a little bit about the previous webinar and some of the results of the survey.
So we're on slide 5 now. This is Patrick Young from Energy Division speaking. This is just an overview of where we stood from the previous webinar. We had the first webinar on October 20th. Supporting materials from that webinar are posted on the link you see on this slide. There is an updated draft charter which describes how this modeling advisory group is envisioned to operate, both in the near term and a little bit in the long term when we get into what happens after we develop the reference plan. There are some meeting notes that were posted, and those meeting notes posted on the CPUC public website are there for convenience and transparency, although we didn't filter them. They should not be relied upon for factual information, but we're going to do our best going forward to correct any typos or misspelled names that show up in these notes. So we'll do our best to correct those things going forward. But again, this is just for convenience and transparency and should not be relied upon for factual information. And the webinar today, we're recording it. The first webinar was not recorded, so if you really want to go back and try to catch what people said and the topics that were covered, then we will be posting a recording of this webinar probably within a day or two of when it completes. So next slide, slide 6. As an outcome of last week's webinar, 2 weeks ago's webinar, we constructed a survey and asked for responses from participants. The results are compiled on that link there, and I understand that anyone can see that link and look at the survey results. Our analysis of the outcome was that it looks like 2 hours is a good format for this webinar. Of course, if needs change in the future, we can adjust that time. It looks like there's not a good reason to, or a good consensus to have a face-to-face meeting prior to December. I think the webinars should serve as a sufficient platform for communicating with the parties and eliminating the logistic hassle of organizing a face-to-face meeting. Based on the feedback we got, we decided to focus this webinar, too, on the case study of SB, what was done in the CAISO's SB 350 regionalization study, because that is a good vehicle for illustrating the detailed inputs that the Resolve model requires and what type of outputs Resolve can produce, and sort of the interactions between the inputs and the outputs based on how you set up Resolve. So we think that's a good vehicle for illustrating the capabilities of Resolve, and it should provide a solid foundation of understanding how Resolve works so that in Webinar 3 we're set up to dive into some of the specific areas that were pointed out in the survey. So we'll we're still scheduled to address those topics that parties are interested in based on the survey. We'll tackle those in webinar 3 and perhaps future webinars if need be. So back to this case study of CAISO's SB 350 regionalization study. Before I turn it over to Nick, who's going to talk about that in detail, I'd like to remind everyone that this study is called for by the SB 350 legislation. So CAISO entitled it the SB 350 study, but really it's a study that focuses on what would happen, what cost savings you could expect if the CAISO were to regionalize. In the slides, we may have used shorthand to refer to this study as SB 350, but really the presentation today is talking about this CAISO regionalization study. So don't confuse us calling the SB 350 study as inferring anything about IRP, because obviously IRP is also part of the implementation of SB 350. So with that, I think I will open it for Q&A before we turn it over to Nick to talk about the CAISO regionalization study as an illustration of how Resolve works.
Hi, this is Kevin Woodruff, consultant for Turn. Hear me? Hello?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you. On slides 3 and 4, I'm kind of curious about sort of just a couple extra details here, like the timeline. Let's start on slide 4, the proposed decision on a reference system plan. You're expecting that in shooting for April or June or?
Yeah, we didn't put the dates on here. You know, until further notice, the scoping memo is the sort of definitive source of when things are happening, and that's what we're shooting for to the best of our ability. You know, we've gotten comments, you know, feedback at various points along the way that what we're trying to do is very challenging, and that we'll be hard pressed to get everything done in the time frame that we've laid out. And we're certainly aware of those challenges and limits, and we will be sticking to the scoping memo until it becomes, you know, patently impossible to maintain that. And that's the best we can tell you at this point.
Okay. So, I mean, you know, and I appreciate that. And I'm one who's been telling you that you're attempting something very challenging among those. But the proposed decision is you're shooting for what time?
Yeah, I think the scoping memo says April.
April. Okay. That was in my head, too. Okay. And that would be the first. You also got on, you know, formal party comments in slide 3 and slide 4, and I gather that's separate.
Yeah, so we have two formal party comments here. The first one would be on the proposal overall.
Right.
And the second formal comments would be specifically on sort of the candidate, sort of the model results, really. It's the candidate plans and the recommended plan that come out of the modeling.
Okay. And then I gather the proposed decision would you know, take everything you've done and then the two sets of formal comments and make some sort of, the ALJ will make some sort of determination based on that.
That's our expectation, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You bet.
Oh, hi, this is Kathy Treleaven, consultant for LSA, and I think Kevin asked my question, Eric, and I understand the answers as best we can get right now. Thanks.
Okay, great. There are no more questions in the Q&A, so at this point, we'll turn it over to... to Nick to get started on the rest of the webinar. Okay, one moment. We seem to be having some technical difficulties. Pause for 2nd. Boris, can you hear me? Yes, you're on, Nick.
Okay, great. Seems like we had a little bit of a technical difficulty there, but hopefully it's smooth sailing from here. So thanks for the introduction, Forrest and Patrick. As both of them just kind of spoke to, today's focus is on a case study of the SB350 regionalization work that we recently completed with the CalISO. Forrest, are you planning to advance the slides through this, or is there any way I can get control of that?
I can advance them, Nick.
Okay. So we're starting on slide 8, which is just kind of the outline for today. I'm going to begin with just a brief recap of the modeling framework of the Resolve model, just to remind everyone who was present last 2 weeks ago, sort of how we came to the development of the Resolve model and the motivations behind it. But then most of our material today is focused on really this case study of the SB350 regionalization work that we've done with the CalISO. So we'll be speaking to an overview of that particular study, the key inputs and assumptions that really shaped that study, and then a summary of the results that came out of that work. Next slide. So before we dive into today's presentation, I did want to take a second to reiterate a few of the things that Patrick had mentioned up front about sort of the goals of presenting this particular case study today. On our last webinar for the modeling advisory group, we spoke a lot about Resolve, but in a very abstract way. And the goal of presenting the SB350 study, the regionalization study today, is to really provide you all with something a little bit more concrete to kind of see what goes into Resolve and what comes out of Resolve and kind of how all these pieces fit together. I should note that the CalISO, as it was basically scoping out its regionalization study, decided to use Resolve specifically because it's a model that's designed to provide optimal portfolios under a variety of different future sort of conditions in the world, and that basically gave it a very useful starting point in order to assess the potential benefits of expanding to a regional market. Now that said, while this study design for the CalISO regionalization study is inherently different from what will be done in the IRP, and I'd like to try to avoid sort of conflating the two as much as possible. So I wanted to kind of note up front that, you know, we have a lot of discussion within this presentation about the scenarios and the assumptions that were made in the SB350 regionalization study. But the purpose of today's presentation isn't really to get into why particular assumptions or decisions were made in the design of that particular study. And so I'll say up front that if we start to get questions that really start to go down that road, I think we'll try to defer them, instead focusing much more on sort of the design of the Resolve model and how all of its pieces fit together from start to finish. So next slide. So we'll pause a couple points throughout the presentation for questions. I think we have a couple natural breakpoints. I'm going to start out with a reminder or a review of the modeling framework that we've designed Resolve to capture, and then I'll kind of talk through a little bit of background on the regionalization study before pausing for questions. So next slide. These first couple slides are going to look familiar to you guys if you were present on the first modeling advisory group webinar, but I think it's useful to kind of go back to the basics and remind everyone of sort of how we've come to where we are with the Resolve model and why it's taken the form that it has. And to do that, I think it's useful to think back to sort of the grid integration challenges that we've been studying for the past 5 or so years. There's been a lot of work that has gone into essentially quantifying what the challenges around grid integration look like, how it becomes more difficult to operate a power system as you have to integrate increasing penetrations of renewables, how this requires you to operate a little bit more flexibly. And I think primarily the biggest challenge that we've seen in any of our modeling so far is the fact that as you move up to these higher and higher penetrations of renewable generation, you start to see this overgeneration phenomenon occurring. This is essentially a phenomenon where there are certain times of the year, certain times of the day, where you have simply too much renewable energy on the system for your load to actually absorb all of it, and you're left with this challenge where essentially you either have to find something else that you can do with that renewable energy, or you can curtail it. Now, of course, that presents an interesting challenge. It's obviously, it creates a issue for meeting state policy goals. If we're saying, you know, we will build 50% renewables, but only 45% will sort of make it to the grid, that's kind of an obstacle that we have to figure out a way to overcome. And so a lot of the work that's been going on in the state recently has begun to sort of shift focus to answer the question of how can we continue to move sort of up this curve to increasing levels of decarbonization and continue to move forward on increasing renewable penetrations in spite of this growing challenge of overgeneration. Next slide. So I'm on slide 12. And basically, at a very simple level, there's a couple things that can be done to basically continue to move up the curve of renewables and to continue to allow us to increase penetrations of renewable generation on the system in spite of the overgeneration challenge. On the far left is one example. You can essentially what we call overbuild your renewable fleet. You can essentially build a little bit of extra renewable generation capacity into the system so that you've basically built in some ability to curtail some renewable generation throughout the year and still meet your policy goals in spite of that amount of curtailment. Now you can see in this illustrative example that ends up resulting often in significant amounts of curtailment if you want to meet a 50% RPS or above and can create some pretty big challenges. At the same time, the other end of the spectrum here is that you can take measures that help you actually absorb surplus overgeneration that would have otherwise been on the system and make use of that energy at other times of the day. The example that we've shown here utilizes energy storage to absorb some midday overgeneration and then use that to meet load in the off-peak periods. Now, it kind of goes without saying that building a system that's able to absorb every megawatt hour of renewable generation in such a way with, for example, storage would also take a tremendous amount of investment and would probably be cost prohibitive. And so you can imagine that there's kind of a sweet spot in the middle of these two strategies, the overbuilding of renewables and the building of storage to distribute energy at other times, where you balance those two things and essentially look at the relative costs of curtailment and the relative costs of investing in storage and find essentially the optimal point between those two where you have a little bit of both. That's essentially the image in which Resolve has been designed. That's the problem that it's been designed to solve. There are, of course, many more dimensions to this problem than just the renewable overbuild and the storage which are illustrated on this slide, things like advanced demand response, the impacts of TOU rates, electric vehicles, building new conventional gas resources. All of these are potential strategies that might be considered as part of an optimal solution. So this is really just intended to be illustrative. Next slide. So this is essentially the problem that Resolve is designed to solve. Resolve is a linear program. It's an optimization model, and it essentially optimizes a portfolio, minimizing its cost over a 20-year period. You can see the key components of the cost metric that Resolve is minimizing in the box at the right, which generally includes all the fixed costs of new investments that are made on the system, which would then include renewables, new renewables, storage resources, demand response, et cetera, as well as all of the costs of operating the grid. This is the variable cost of running all of the power plants that have to be operated, start costs, carbon costs, O&M, fuel costs, et cetera. And I think a crucial thing to understand about Resolve, and one respect in which it differs from some of the other capacity expansion models out there, is that all of these decisions are sort of being made in a single step. That's kind of the nature of linear programming. There are other models out there that kind of make these decisions independently, which is to say they'll maybe choose to add some capacity in a certain year and then simulate how that system operates, and then go back and choose to add more capacity in the next year and then operate that system. In Resolve, we've essentially internalized that operational model within the capacity investment decisions. So that's a sort of important thing to recognize about Resolve that sometimes makes it a little bit difficult to understand exactly how the model itself is working. So I think I've mentioned a little bit about many of the solutions, the integration solutions that Resolve considers, but we have just a quick list of those once again. The key point here being that there are many, many strategies or measures that can be taken alongside renewable generation to continue to push the state towards meeting its future carbon goals and integrating higher penetrations of renewables. Next slide. So we'll go into a little bit of background on the regionalization study, and then I'll pause for some questions before we go into details on the input assumptions in that particular study. Next slide. So Patrick mentioned a little bit about this in his introduction, but essentially the SB 350 legislation essentially required CAISO as part of its effort to expand into a regional entity to conduct a study looking at what the impacts of such an effort to establish a regional entity would be upon California ratepayers. The legislation is very specific in the impacts that CAISO was responsible for examining, which are called out in the blue box here, including benefits to ratepayers, overall impact on the California economy, environmental impacts, impacts on disadvantaged communities, greenhouse gases and other pollutants, reliability, and the integration of renewable energy. So this is it's a broad study and has to be in order to touch on all of these requirements. And so CAISO essentially recruited a wide range of consultants, a large team of consultants, including E3, Brattle, and Aspen, and the Berkeley Energy and Resources Group, in order to sort of put the pieces of this together in order to quantify each of these impacts. Next slide. So at first glance, this is a bit of a busy figure, but this is intended to show sort of the analytical framework that was used in the regionalization study conducted by CAISO. There are many sort of pieces here and many arrows flowing from different boxes to different boxes. But sort of what I wanted to illustrate here is sort of where Resolve sits in all of this. And you can see that we've kind of tried to highlight that with the first orange box, which calls out the role of Resolve at the very beginning of the CAISO regionalization study. Essentially, Resolve was used in this particular study to generate the portfolios, the optimal portfolios, under a variety of different scenarios. And those portfolios then flowed forward into a variety of other analyses that took place within this study. So it is important, to remember in all of this that subsequent to the Resolve analysis that was done within the SB 350 study, other analysis was sort of necessary to touch on some of the important legislative requirements of the study. For example, the environmental impacts and the impacts on disadvantaged communities. But Resolve was really kind of the starting point for all of this in terms of its genesis of the portfolios that sort of flowed into each other piece of the modeling. Next slide. So Resolve within the context of the regionalization study that was done was really used to test two sort of impacts on the California portfolio, two impacts of transforming the California grid into more of a regional entity. The first was essentially what is the impact of essentially having a regional operator to operate the grid more efficiently on the California portfolio. And what this question was intended to essentially examine is how sort of moving from the bilateral trading systems that we have today and the friction that exists within those systems to a more centralized and optimized dispatch might actually influence procurement decisions that are made within the state of California to meet its higher RPS goals. So essentially, you can imagine that in a centrally operated and optimized grid that has sort of a perfect dispatch, that might actually influence what types of resources California might want to procure to meet its renewable needs. The second effect that was tested in the regionalization study was essentially the effect of establishing a regional transmission tariff, which would really sort of open the doors or really facilitate the possibility of allowing California to much more easily contract for large quantities of out-of-state renewable resources. And so the second effect that is tested in the regionalization study is really the impact of essentially the question, how does having more access to high-quality out-of-state resources influence California's renewable portfolio going forward? Next slide, slide 18. So the regionalization study essentially designed three scenarios in order to test these two effects. The first scenario studied, you can think of as essentially somewhat of a base case. It's intended to reflect current practices within the ISO. And so this is a scenario in which most of the renewable generation that's procured to meet future goals is procured from within the state of California, and California's ability to export surplus power is somewhat limited by the friction that exists within the bilateral system that we operate within today. The second scenario considered within this study is one that essentially looked at that first point that we just looked at on the prior slide. If you were to relax some of the constraints around how much power can be exported and assume you have centralized, optimized dispatch, how does that influence the portfolio within state? And then the third scenario that was looked at was one that basically opened the doors to significant quantities of out-of-state renewable procurement in addition to that centralized operations in order to test the impact of that second driver we just looked at. Next slide. So this is for the more quantitative folks on the call. This is a summary of the key assumptions that differed among scenarios, or basically what levers were pulled within Resolve in order to get towards, in order to essentially define the scenarios that we just described in words. So we varied these three key assumptions across the different scenarios. The first is the limit on exports from the CAISO, which changed from 2,000 in scenario 1A to 8,000 megawatts in scenarios 2 and 3. Scenarios 2 and 3 also essentially removed the hurdle rate friction that exists between the CalISO and other BAs that were considered as part of the regional footprint. And then the key other distinction between these scenarios is basically the assumed availability of out-of-state resources. And you can see that is held constant in scenarios 1 and 2, but then increases from 5,000 to 11,000 megawatts in scenario 3 to capture that, to try to capture that effect. So that's intended to just give you guys all a little bit of background on what was done at the highest level in the regionalization study. I think this is probably the first point where it's appropriate to pause for any clarifying questions, but before we do open it up for that, just note that the next section is one where we'll get into a lot of specifics on the key assumptions that went into that. So at this point, I guess I'd like to just see if there are any clarifying questions that we can get off the table at the moment. So a reminder, if you want to ask any questions at this point, use *6 in order to be placed in the Q&A queue. And go ahead and identify your name and the organization that you represent when you start your question. Mandeep, I believe you're up.
Hi, this is Mandeep from Southern California Edison. This is just more of a procedure question, just so Edison is aware. When will the resolve model be available for us to see the input, see how it works, just so we can play around with it?
Yes, the plan is to make it available. we're still working on the timing. There's some specific customizations that we've asked E3 to do to get it ready for the work that we're trying to accomplish here in IRP. And so we're still working on a timeline for when that will become available. I think just as a heads up, it will be released as sort of an as-is type of product. We won't be able to offer any kind of technical assistance for parties that want to run the model on their own. So it'll be released, for you to inspect and review, but really it'll be the QC and E3 sort of running the models, and we just don't have the resources or capacity to sort of provide technical assistance associated with that. But we will make it available, and still working on the timeline for when that will be.
Great. Quick follow-up. Will there be, like, instructions or anything, or is it just going to be the model when it becomes available for us to just figure out?
Yeah, no, we are hoping to develop documentation. It may not be a full, as if this were a product being released and sold in the market, but we will do our best to provide some documentation to help facilitate that. But again, our focus is on, sort of providing transparency around, the code, but not necessarily just not having the resources to really help folks troubleshoot issues that may arise if they choose to run the software on their own.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, this is Paul Klapka from Southern California Edison. A couple of slightly detailed questions, which you might get into later, but on slide 13, you talked about the costs that you look at in Resolve. Do you look at them hourly, daily, or sub-hourly? And the second question, what are your decision variables for allowing the model to make decisions?
Okay, we're going to have to pause, see if we can pause for technical considerations for one moment. Thanks for the question. still pausing for technical considerations.
Forrest, can you hear me?
Yes. Great. Do you remember the question from SCE?
Yeah, I remember the question. I'm seeing a whited out screen at the moment.
Okay, I'll see if I can address that, and you can feel free to go ahead with your response.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for the question, Paul. It is a little bit into the details. What I can say now is we have an hourly operational model within Resolve, so that's kind of the most granular time interval that the model considers. And as far as decision variables, there are many, many, many of them, probably more to list, more than we can list verbally here, but they kind of fall into two buckets. One is decision variables on the installed capacities of different resource types that are, you know, your candidate resources, and the other category is all of the sort of decision variables that would fall under a sort of reduced form production cost model. So decisions around, you know, at what levels to operate PowerPoints and flows between regions and things like that.
And Paul, this is Arnie Olson. I would just add that there is also within the model kind of a module that looks at reserve requirements. So regulation and load following reserve requirements, which do vary depending on how much renewable generation there is on the system in that given hour. So there's some offline modeling that's gone into parameterizing both the need for those products and then the consequences of any shortfalls in those products with respect to loss of load and additional renewable curtailment.
So, hey, Arnie, it's Mark Nelson. I got one other question. Can you remind me, I know there's the 5,000 megawatts of out-of-state renewables that are in the first two scenarios, then in the third scenario there's an additional amount. Where do the 5 and 11 come from, and then does Resolve run after that to fill in the residual need?
So the 5,000 and 11,000 megawatts of available supply from out of state are basically inputs that were decided on by the study team. The renewable supply, really the first place it came from was from the RPS calculator, but we really didn't have in there, you know, this ability to add new wind in the Northwest and New Mexico over existing transmission. That just wasn't in the most recent version of the RPS calculator, and none of the stakeholders had asked us to put it in. But this was something that the ISO study team thought was a reasonable assumption to make, you know, in order to, you know, not give the impression that the regional market is the only way to procure out-of-state resources. So those 5,000 megawatts of out-of-state wind and solar, some of them are solar as well, are available in all three scenarios for the model to select. But the model doesn't always pick all of it. It depends on the relative economics. Then in scenario three, you know, again, it was an assumption of the study team that the regional market would be reasonable to assume that the regional market would facilitate the availability of 3,000 megawatts each of additional high-quality wind from the New Mexico and Wyoming zones. And so, again, the model can pick from those resources along with the original 5,000 and all the in-state stuff to develop an optimal portfolio.
So these weren't forced in. These were just available, and then at that point, Resolve operates to choose from those plus whatever else the palette of generation was that it could pick from.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, that was helpful. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Ben Morazadeh from PG&E. I just have a follow-up question. You said you're going to customize Resolve for the SB350 IRP. We'd like to know what kind of changes are going to be made to resolve.
Yeah, we've got a number of sort of functionality updates that we're working on at the moment. Basically, just the sort of short list that we're working on is to implement a constraint on GHGs, which was not considered within the context of the regionalization study, but with a lot of the work that's been going on lately seems to be an area of interest. So we'll have the capability to implement a GHG constraint on the CalISO. We are working to refine the internal planning reserve margin logic within the model in order to essentially sort of better replicate the PRM calculation, including a simplified ELCC representation for renewables. And then we're also working to explore some functionality related to a better representation of the supply curve for demand-side resources. You'll see in the SB 350 study, regionalization study, that a lot of the demand-side assumptions were treated as fixed. And right now we're currently sort of in an exploratory phase to figure out what we can get done on the demand side within Resolve for this IRP. Those are probably the main areas that we're focusing on at the moment.
That's very helpful. Thank you so much. I have another question on the on the slide 13 as well. You know, the resource selection and unit commitment are, I think, more of mixed integer programming problems, but I was wondering if you guys do any unit commitment in this process or only dispatch.
You're right. Like, in traditionally speaking, you know, mixed integer programming has often been used for to model things like unit commitment, and we certainly can't capture that type of dynamic perfectly within the linear program. We have tried to sort of parameterize that relationship as well, and so we do have sort of some requirements that plants basically operate above their PMIN while they're online, but because this is a linear program, the model actually allows you to commit essentially fractions of units at a given time. That's sort of where the continuous linear function comes into the problem. So you're right, it's not a perfect model of operations, but it's sort of a necessary simplification to endogenize the operations into the linear program.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Hi, this is Phil Muller on behalf of Ormat, and I have a couple of questions for you. You can hear me okay?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, first on slide 13, I want to verify that when Resolve is looking at the different resource scenarios, they're going to be accounting clearly for the resource behavior. For instance, how 1 megawatt of geothermal will give you the same amount of energy as 4 megawatts of solar and reduce that peak potential overbuild or curtailment issue. And I'm assuming that's kind of built in your when Resolve is picking different resources will account for that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the simplest example is just thinking about renewables. You know, the solar resource that is considered has a different hourly shape from the wind resources in the model, from the geothermal resources, et cetera.
Okay. And the second question is on slide 18, when you talk about scenario 2 and scenario 3 for that matter, the assumption that you're basically using exports to reduce the amount of curtailment that needs to be done on the renewable resources. And the question is, well, then how is that export, how is the renewable component of that export accounted for? Is it just basically assumed that, well, the renewable stuff actually stays here, what we're actually exporting is stuff that otherwise would have to, that we couldn't curtail otherwise? So does that have any implications on California's RPS requirements and RPS behaviors as far as meeting those requirements?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. So the way that we treated this in the SB 350 regionalization study was that any sort of generation that was exported was assumed to be sort of to have been stripped of the renewable attribute. So if you generate a megawatt hour of renewables in California, but that megawatt hour ends up being exported to some other region, California still takes credit for the renewable production associated with that in its RPS compliance.
Okay, so you're basically assuming that there is some other generation that is not renewable at that moment that can be offset by that export, effectively.
Yeah, Phil, this is Arnie. It's not really an assumption. It's because the model represents the rest of the WEC in its operations as well. So if the model can find a home for that megawatt hour somewhere else outside of California, then it will. If it happens that
right.
the rest of the WEC can't accept it either, then it would just be curtailed, and then there wouldn't be any REC generation.
Right, but it assumes that that there is some non-renewable generation that can be that would otherwise be offset but can't be offset operationally.
Well, again, it finds whether there is or not. So if there is a dispatchable resource that can be reduced, then it will do that. If not, then it would recognize it as a spilled megawatt hour of renewables, and there'd be no REC.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to note also that there's a GHG wrinkle there. You know, the RPS thing that we just talked about, that's our understanding of how the RPS rules currently read, that the RPS is defined as megawatt hours generated divided by retail sales. For greenhouse gases, there is currently no mechanism for a California entity to receive any credit for greenhouse gas reductions associated with exported power. So that's a wrinkle that we're sort of working on
right.
making sure that we have that appropriately reflected in the resolve modeling. That we get direct credit, but not necessarily the GHG credit for that export.
Okay. Which is odd.
Hi, this is Kevin Kitts from US Geothermal, and I just wanted to ask a follow-up question about the last related to the last couple ones. And in a traditional fossil fuel, perhaps dispatch order, the most expensive plant would be dispatched curtailed first. In last meetings. Resolve slides, I couldn't find it again, but it mentioned that any curtailed plant would be, the cost of that curtailment would be still attributed to the cost of operating the system. In other words, in the old vernacular, a take-or-pay contract. And so what's interesting about renewable is that the dispatch order sort of flipped on its head. The most economical plant to dispatch is actually the least cost plant. And I was wondering if the model reflects that, or if that makes sense to you.
This is Arnie. What the model will do is, if a resource has a zero variable cost, then those resources are all treated the same by the model. And they'd be the last ones that are dispatched downwards. So it'd find resources where you could save some fuel by reducing their dispatch. Once you run out of those, then you're left with resources that are zero variable cost. So we treat all those as identical. It wouldn't assume that there would be a savings, for example, if I had a renewable PPA at $50 a megawatt hour and another one at $70 a megawatt hour. It wouldn't assume that there would be a savings from picking the higher cost PPA to dispatch first. That just would introduce a whole other wrinkle of which contracts had curtailment, which type of curtailment provisions and how many megawatt hours. It's just a hugely complicated factor. So it treats all the renewables as the same. Treats them all as if they have zero variable cost, if they do have zero variable cost within the structure of the data inputs. If you stopped there, if there was no binding RPS, then there'd be really no cost to doing that. There was a resource available, I couldn't use it, so it just gets spilled like we do with hydro today. What makes the RPS different is that it's a binding production quota. So if you do spill the renewables, then you have to make up for that production by overbuilding the portfolio. And it's that overbuild that represents the true cost of the renewable spill to the LSE that doesn't get the production. And Resolve reflects exactly that cost within its very structure, because the overbuild component is built right into the way that the costs are minimized within the optimization function. So we can get a shadow price, and Nick will show you a slide where we have a shadow price on curtailment on that RPS constraint, which tells you exactly how expensive this constraint and this curtailment is.
Well, it seems like, as, for example, as solar goes down in price and its installed capacity goes up, it becomes cheaper and cheaper to just go ahead and curtail it. My experience is in geothermal, obviously, and, we're always going to be more expensive than a megawatt, an instantaneous megawatt hour of, and all the contracts are written as megawatt hours. So it's more expensive to curtail. It's more expensive to the system to curtail a geothermal megawatt hour than it is to curtail a new solar megawatt hour. And so it seems like that in evaluating what to do with that excess capacity, the actual cost of those curtailments would be important to track to get the optimal solution.
Let me try one more thing, and then I think we have to move on. But there's a difference between existing plant and new investment decisions. So for all of the existing plant, all those fixed costs are totally sunk, and there's no savings from picking one versus the other. So for the existing plant, as I described, it just curtails, that doesn't matter which ones are curtailed, it just spills and records that as a, spilled energy with no REC associated with it. When it comes to building new plant, then absolutely the marginal impact of geothermal and solar are very different, and they're fully taken into consideration. So if you're curtailing 50% of the marginal solar plant because you already have a whole bunch of solar online, and if the geothermal is less than twice as expensive as the solar, then under those conditions, the model would probably pick the geothermal. On the other hand, if you're only curtailing 25% of the solar on a marginal basis and the geothermal is twice as expensive as the solar, then it would still continue to pick the solar until the marginal curtailment got to be high enough.
Okay.
I think
thank you.
In the interest of time, we probably have to move on. But maybe if that doesn't clear it up, then maybe you can just get us offline.
Okay. Thank you.
Hello. This is Dave Smith with Transwest Express. Going back to page 13, you write you have a bunch of solutions written down. And when I look at those solutions, I imagine the problem you're solving is called the integration problem, or I'd call it maybe the overgeneration problem. I know that in looking at the study, I'm not the SB 350 study that you're about to go through. I think that I just want to get this clarified. You didn't really test these other solutions, energy storage, advanced demand response, or others, because that wasn't the nature of the study. But I believe you did look at how a diverse portfolio would help reduce the overgeneration problem. Is that correct? And is that, I just want to, for the purposes of this, going through what you've done, it seems to me like that's the one that was done as part of the SB 350 study. And the other ones are something, I'm not sure how far you went into looking at those solutions.
Yeah, so Dave, of the ones on this list here, the renewable overbuild is one. The diverse renewable portfolio, as you said, is just a natural part of the optimization, because each renewable has a different profile. We do have energy storage available for the model to select, and in the current practice case, it does pick some additional battery storage to help out within our operating reserves. So that is available as a solution and is selected in some cases. The conventional gas generation is also available as a solution, but we didn't see any cases in which that was picked. We didn't have the advanced demand response fully integrated as a supply curve within the ISO study, but we've been doing some work with LBNL on characterizing the supply curve for advanced demand response, which we hope to be able to incorporate, as Nick said, into the current version of the software.
Okay, thank you. Look forward to the review of those as you go through this. Thanks.
Hello, this is Sarita Sarwate for Plika. I'm just wondering on slide 16, you've got two boxes, the resolve model that creates certain outputs, and then you put those, I guess, into the production cost modeling to do more detailed analysis. And I was just wondering, can you give me a flavor of what sort of things would go from resolve into the production cost modeling? What the purpose of the second box is? What comes out of that?
Well, within the ISO SB350 study, there were a lot of additional considerations beyond just, you know, how does the California renewable portfolio change? You know, this is a study of combining the operations of multiple balancing authorities and reducing, you know, wheeling rates and transactional friction among, you know, many or most of the 38 balancing authorities in the West. So that study needed a lot of granularity and resolution on transmission topology and, you know, marginal loss factors for each system and what the wheeling rates are for each system and hurdle rates. And you know, unit commitment was a big part of that because, you know, a larger footprint can lead to more efficient commitment of large lumpy generating units across that area. So just a whole bunch of additional detail that was needed to address the study questions that were part of the ISO's expansion study. And so what came from Resolve was the renewable portfolios and the output shapes of those portfolios, which were selected using Resolve and its more simplified operations. But then those were subjected to a much more detailed treatment within the production simulation optimizer model that Rattle used.
So was the production cost simulation done on a balancing authority basis or anything like that, or?
Well, within PSO, the production simulation models the entire Western Interconnection region. And in the current practice scenario, they would assume that all the 38 balancing authorities continue to operate as they do today, separately, but with some coordination through bilateral trading and transmission scheduling. And then in the regional scenarios, they would assume consolidation of those balancing authorities and reduction of regulation requirements and frictionless transactions and optimal dispatch across that larger footprint.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Pushkar Wagle here from Clean RCI on behalf of Banax. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, just two questions. One is about you've indicated that the investment decisions and system operational constraints and resource operational constraints, all of them are sort of solved simultaneously in Resolve, as opposed to, I think Nick said, that some of the models that add a resource in a given year and test whether that's based on its operation, whether it's economic or not. Could you elaborate a little bit more? Because I'm familiar with those latter kind of models, but I was just wondering if you can just describe in a couple of sentences how that decision is done when you say simultaneously, or is some sort of a loop that you have internalized in this single optimization process?
Yeah, I'll do my best to put this in layman's terms as much as I can. But so Resolve is a linear program, which essentially means that it's basically what you have is a bunch of decision variables and then a bunch of constraints. Mm-hmm. And for it to be a linear program, each of the constraints that you have has to be sort of linear in nature. It has to be expressed essentially as a linear equation. And in fact, there are many sort of restrictions on the types of things that you can actually do within those sorts of linear constraints, but I won't go sort of down that rabbit hole. So you have a bunch of variables and you have a bunch of constraints, and our constraints reflect things like a RPS target, which is sort of an annual constraint, as well as system reliability, as well as meeting hourly load. And then there are also all these sort of operational constraints on sort of how the system's going to operate. And you can imagine sort of your variables and your constraints all end up in sort of one big matrix at once, and those constraints reflect both operations and investments. So what you have is this big matrix, a big linear matrix that's essentially a very, very large system of equations, and you know, a linear solver will apply some algorithms to essentially solve that very large system of equations all in a single step, if you will. So that's kind of what I mean when I say that this is all happening somewhat simultaneously and not sequentially.
Okay, that's helpful. And second quick question is, you know, you have this single optimization model that is, you know, explicitly treating the cost and specific solutions, and as well as some interaction between those solutions. Does the model display some sort of intermediate step that provides that interaction between number of solutions? Is there a way to visualize that rather than applying one solution at a time and see what comes out?
Unfortunately, not really. That's kind of the nature of linear programming. You kind of
Right.
have inputs and then you kind of get outputs, and there's many ways that you can look at your outputs or diagnostics that you can use. You know, for instance, we'll show this later, you can look at shadow prices on various constraints. Et cetera. So it's kind of, you have to look at your inputs and your outputs and the diagnostics that you have and use that to kind of assess, you know, how the model is performing.
And this is Jimmy also from E3. So just a shadow price, I think for some might be a relatively technical term. So basically, if a constraint has a shadow price greater than zero, that means it's doing something to the optimization. And so when we pull these shadow prices, we can say, well, is for example, the planning reserve margin constraint, is that actually doing something, or would we be meeting it given all the other constraints we gave the system? So that's one way to kind of peer into the solution and ask a few what-if questions, but, you know, that has its limitations as well.
I got you. That's all I have. Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Bob Fagan from Synapse on behalf of California ORA. I guess I have three questions. I think two of them are easy and one might not be so easy. You talked about you are making, you're modifying the resolve so you can do greenhouse gas constraints in CAISO. Will you be able to, will that be somewhat flexible? Will you also be able to impose greenhouse gas constraints on WEC or on parts of WEC, or is it going to be strictly limited to CAISO or to California? My second question is just if you can talk maybe a little bit about, I assume you have a lot of flexibility on whether or not you can soften constraints, hard constraints versus soft constraints in the model, and how you would approach that. And then my third question just had to do with, on page 16, the woman earlier asked about the production cost simulations. You know, I understand you get a lot more granularity with the production cost simulations. I guess I wanted to see if you had any particular, you know, lessons learned about, you know, using the two different modeling platforms in that process, given that in this process, it's not clear if, when, or how production cost simulations might also be used in addition to resolve. And, you know, and I'm sure there'll be more conversations about this, but if there's anything you can say at, you know, sort of at this point from a process perspective on how that worked out for you, working with the two different modeling platforms during the regionalization study process.
Sure, thanks. So going through your questions one by one, as far as the GHG constraint goes, essentially the way that resolve is set up is it's essentially set up to optimize the renewable build-out and the build-out of all other resources within a single zone. And that zone that we're focusing on for this work, both the regionalization study and the IRP, is the CAISO. And so that constraint is kind of tailored to that specific zone, and that's kind of how we're building it. So we're not really intending to flexibly build in sort of a WEC-wide GHG constraint in that respect. When it comes to hard and soft constraints, yes, we have a little bit of latitude there. I'm not sure how much we'll be sort of playing around with those in the context of this work unless we run into technical modeling issues representing certain things as hard constraints. And as far as the third question, your question on sort of the alignment of these two models, you know, we definitely went through a process working with Brattle in the regionalization study to try to see sort of how well key output metrics between the two models were lining up. And, you know, we did our best to kind of square input assumptions between the two models and look at some key outputs. And I think we were able to get to a pretty satisfactory point with, for example, a key metric like renewable curtailment, which is one of the big drivers of the cost among these scenarios. We were able to kind of get to a point where we were seeing pretty comparable results between the two models, and I think that's something that gave us a little bit of comfort.
Yeah, this is Arnie. I would just add that that's, I think, going to need to be an area of ongoing research, which is, you know, just how important is it to reflect things like unit commitment, you know, within the operations to be able to get to satisfactory answers on the investment questions. I think we feel pretty comfortable that we're getting very reasonable and, you know, interesting outputs from Resolve given its current configuration. But we definitely are, you know, open to the possibility that there's something important that we're missing given our simplified operational model. And, you know, ideally would like to go through a more detailed diagnostic process and see if there's some additional parameters that we would want to include in Resolve.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Forrest, it seems like in the interest of time, maybe we should move on.
Hello? This is Kevin Woodruff.
Kevin, I was just about to cut you off. But.
Well, nah, no. yeah, I had myself on mute. Sorry. The GHG constraint, I think I understand. Basically, you're going to add a constraint that limits GHG emissions from the CalISO zone. Will Resolve, I have a couple questions about that. Will Resolve also produce emission results for the entire WEC? So we can see sort of what the impact is for CalISO and across WEC-wide?
Yeah, that is a metric we can produce.
Okay, so it's an output that can be okay, very good.
So we don't model Canada and
Sorry?
We don't model part of the WEC, so it would be kind of a not a complete emissions picture for the entire WEC.
Okay. That will be better than nothing, because you clearly need to look at the entire WEC to really understand sort of the CalISO results you're going to get. Mm-hmm. So just a comment there. I wanted to make sure you were able to get that result. I think all my other questions have been answered. Thank you.
Hi, this is Dariush Shomohammadi with California Wind Energy Association. Question I have is related to calculation of ratepayer benefits and if you actually even attempt to do that. If you attempt to do California ratepayer benefit, do you account for the fact that as we generate solar or any wind or solar or any renewable RPS generator in the state, and then it gets, rather than getting curtailed, it gets exported to out of the state and reduces some maybe coal generation somewhere else, coal or gas generation somewhere else, that there is a payment that the ratepayers pay in California for that generation, whatever it happens to be, it's a PPA rate. And the fact that maybe in the process of exporting, we paid a negative, actually we had to pay to have that power picked up by Utah, say, just say another state. So a ratepayer here pays, say, $50-$60 for the megawatt hour of solar generation, and then, or wind generation or whatever. And then we pay and put another $10 on top of it, and give it to Utah for So, do you account for these type of financial transactions that takes place as we export this over generation?
Yeah. So, Darius, this is Arnie. I think the strict answer to your question is no. The model takes a societal perspective. So it's minimizing the total cost of, you know, serving load and meeting all the constraints. as if the entire system was owned by a single entity, and all the ratepayers, you know, were basically that owner of that system. So there's nothing.
All
WIC
ratepayers, basically.
Well, it's really all CalISO ratepayers. But you're right. I'd have to think about that wrinkle between WEC ratepayers and CalISO ratepayers. But there's really no kind of market transactions reflected in the model. And so in the ISO study, this was an additional piece that we needed to layer on top of even the PSO simulation, which was the layering on of the team methodology and how the California portfolio would interact with the rest of the market and what the market price effects would be from different portfolios in California and changes to the footprint of regional operations. And those actually were quite an important component in the total impact results that were calculated as part of the ISO study. The market price effects tend to amplify the production simulation benefits, and you see a larger benefit to California ratepayers because under regionalization, we're paying less for other loads in the WEC to take our surplus renewable generation. So that kind of additional portfolio effect to California ratepayers is not captured within Resolve. It's just minimizing the total cost of you know, building and operating the resources to meet the California loads.
That part I understand, and in fact, probably no objection to that, because that's how the system will supposed to operate. But at the end of the day, if in selecting a potential... Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Dariush, this is Forrest. We're just we're really pressed for time.
Sure.
We're
okay.
Behind. Lots of interesting discussion that we can have at a later point, but I'd like to just finish the last question and let E3 move on, if that's all right.
Sounds good. All right.
Thank you, Dariush.
Hi, this is Jan Reed of Coast Economic Consulting. In the assumptions of this study, are you suggesting that we port some of these assumptions over to the modeling task that we're doing currently?
Jan, this is Nick's going to go through a lot of those assumptions in the next section, and I think there's going to be some commentary in there about which ones were kind of specific to the ISO study and which ones we'll want to revisit as we look at the IRP.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so Forrest, we can jump into the next section here.
Yeah, great.
This next section is talking about basically the key inputs and assumptions that went into the regionalization study. I'm going to try to flip through these fairly quickly, since once again we're not that focused on the specific numbers, discussing the specific numbers today, but more just sort of illustrating the flavors of assumptions that actually go into the model. I think this slide is just a useful starting point for that because it helps sort of situate us with sort of what different types of inputs are sort of key to Resolve. We've broken this out on this slide into essentially fixed inputs and the candidate resources. Fixed inputs being basically things that are assumed to be sort of static parts of the portfolio, exogenous inputs, both supply and demand side. And then the candidate resources reflecting basically all of the options that Resolve has when it's basically choosing how to meet all of the constraints and build up a least cost portfolio. You can see all of these flowing into our Resolve model in the middle of the page, where through the articulation of the various constraints, the optimization chooses a least cost combination of resources, and that's what leads us to our least cost portfolio. So that's just a starting point for where we're going. Slide 22. I guess I wanted to start out by highlighting some of the study-specific assumptions that were made in the SB 350 regionalization study. These are kind of summarized at a high level here. As Arnie alluded to earlier in discussing out-of-state wind, there were a number of basically assumptions that the study team, including CalISO and the consultants, came to as basically appropriate to include in this particular study of regionalization. So we've included such factors as the load impacts of time of use rates and the load impact of electric vehicles on future load shapes. We also decided to manually include a couple specific types of resources in the future portfolios, including a 500 megawatt increment of pump storage and another 500 megawatt increment of geothermal. So you can consider those as fixed components of this particular study that may not be applicable in the IRP work. And then there's a couple other bullets here basically describing some of the other assumptions that we had on candidate resources within the context of the SB 350 regionalization work. Next slide. So looking into essentially that first category of inputs, the fixed inputs, one of the major sort of important starting points for Resolve is what does the existing portfolio of renewable resources look like in the model. For this, the SB 350 study leaned pretty heavily on the PUC's RPS calculator, I believe version 6.1. And what you can see in the graphic here is essentially the mix of renewable resources that was assumed to be either existing at the time of the study's commencement or representative of plants that already have contracts but may not yet be operational. So what you can see here is that we've got a build out through approximately 2020 that maintains current policy goals and thereafter levels off. And you can see this big white triangle showing up now. That's essentially the renewable need that Resolve is responsible for filling in order to meet the RPS constraint in the model. So that triangle is essentially, you know, in many respects, that's a big piece of the gap that Resolve is filling in with new resources. Also worth highlighting here is the assumption on behind-the-meter PV. That was also treated in this study as a fixed input, and we deferred to the CEC's IPER forecast, which I think projected 16 to 17 gigawatts of capacity in CAISO by 2030. Next slide. So another key set of fixed assumptions in the SB 350 regionalization study is what the conventional resource fleet looks like. Here we've relied pretty heavily on the past assumptions made in the LTPP regarding the schedule of OTC retirements, and we've updated that to reflect the announced retirement of Diablo. So in the graphic on the right, you can see kind of this declining gas generation fleet over time that reflects basically either planned or announced retirements. All of this flows into, of course, the operational model. So in each year that's modeled, you know, that thermal fleet is evolving a little bit based on what these input assumptions look like. Because we're modeling a large chunk of the West in operations, we also have to make some assumptions about essentially what the coal fleet outside of the West, outside of California, is doing. For that, we've leaned pretty heavily on work that's been done at TEPSI while supplementing that with some additional announced retirements. And finally, I think we've included a few planned additions on the gas side, but what's also worth noting is that this is an area where Resolve has the capability where if gas generation was needed to meet load in any period, it would be able to add it as a candidate resource. Of course, we never saw that happen in our scenarios for SB 350. Next slide. I think it's helpful to also illustrate sort of the components of the load forecast and how each one of those flows into the model. Essentially, we've treated a lot of these as fixed inputs for the SB 350 regionalization study, and you can see in this sequence of graphics how each one of those assumptions on factors like efficiency and behind-the-meter PV and electric vehicles and then time-of-use rates all sort of ultimately impact the load shape that's being modeled that impacts the value of any investment that you might make. So in each of these graphics, you know, if you look at box number 2, for example, what that's showing you is essentially the load impact of energy efficiency. The dotted line in that box represents the load shape before efficiency is taken into account. The solid line shows you the resulting shape after efficiency is taken into account. And each one of these sort of builds upon the previous one. So you can see the ultimate load shape down in box 6 that ends up being simulated in Resolve. Next slide. So this is shifting gears a little bit into a discussion around the candidate resources that are modeled in Resolve, with a first focus on renewables. Within California, we've got some decent geographic detail on renewable cost and potential according to the zones that you see highlighted in the graphic on the right. These roughly correspond to small aggregations of the CREZs that basically constitute the main unit of geography in the RPS calculator. And so for each of these zones, we have some assumption of the quantity of wind and solar and geothermal and the corresponding cost of each of those resources in each of those zones. A lot of the information that was used in the SB 350, again, came straight from the RPS calculator with a few explicit adjustments based on stakeholder feedback in this process. Next slide. So we already touched on this a little bit early on, but the assumptions about the availability of out-of-state renewables is a scenario-specific assumption. In scenarios 1 and 2, we've assumed that 5,000 megawatts of out-of-state resources can be built and delivered on the existing transmission system. In scenario 3, this is expanded to include the large new potential transmission generation projects for wind in Wyoming and New Mexico, which expands that pool to 11,000 megawatts. And so that change between scenarios 2 and 3, again, is one of the key distinctions between the portfolios that come out in those two cases. Next slide. So I've talked a little bit about sort of the geography that we have on renewable resources throughout the model. What I wanted to highlight here is that the cost and the performance of renewables basically varies on a region-specific basis. So in each region, we have an estimate of essentially the capital cost and the fixed operating cost that would correspond to building a particular plant in that area, as well as the capacity factor that you'd expect. And these different assumptions lead you to different PPA prices or LCOEs for each of the potential candidate resources, which ultimately is sort of a differentiation that allows Resolve to sort of make the decision between citing wind in one region versus citing it in another. And you can see some kind of illustrative graphics that we have here that show how those prices essentially differ from one region to another. Another thing that I'll just point out while we're here is that Resolve does, in fact, take as an input essentially a levelized cost for renewables. And so those of you who are familiar, for example, with the RPS calculator, the levelized cost logic that's been incorporated into Resolve is very similar to what we've done previously in the RPS calculator to translate inputs like capital cost and fixed O&M and capacity factor into a proxy for a PPA price. Next slide. So what I showed you just a second ago with renewable costs was really just a snapshot of costs for a single year, but it's important to recognize that Resolve is optimizing over a longer time horizon and thus takes as an input a forecast of future prices of renewables as well as all other generation options moving out through time. And that forecast of future costs takes into account actually a number of factors. Probably most important are one, the capital cost reductions that are assumed for various technologies, and then two, the sunsets of the federal and state tax credits that are available for wind and solar. All of these things kind of result in different costs for renewable resources, as well as storage and potentially other technologies in the 2030 timeframe than we see in the 2015 timeframe. And this change in technology cost through time actually does impact sort of the timing of optimal decisions and the composition of the optimal portfolio. Next slide. So each of the renewable resources also has some incorporation of transmission availability and cost included with it. This logic is, again, quite similar to what we've had in the RPS calculator in the past. But essentially, in each of those zones that we looked at, we have some expression or some input assumption of how much of that resource can be installed on the existing transmission system, and then beyond that point, what it costs to build new transmission for each of those resources. So this is another factor or another way in which Resolve distinguishes between renewables in different zones throughout the state. All else equal, Resolve will tend to build renewables where no new transmission is needed, but to the extent that that chunk of capacity gets built up, Resolve will sort of figure out where it's most cost effective given the transmission and the resource costs. Next slide. I don't want to go too much into the specific numbers that we're showing on this slide, but I did want to highlight for you guys that we do have basically detailed assumptions on the costs of various storage technologies built into the model, including multiple different battery technologies and then pumped hydro storage. Each of these storage technologies is essentially characterized by both a capacity component to reflect the sort of generating unit and then an energy component, which essentially reflects the size of the storage reservoir or the duration of the storage device. So both of these factors are incorporated into the optimization. And in fact, right now, Resolve actually has the flexibility to essentially determine an optimal storage duration given the two sort of component costs that it's considering. Next slide. This is, again, shifting gears just a little bit to talk about operations. But again, all of the resources that are considered as candidate resources for the model flow into the operational model that's sort of internal to Resolve once again. And each of those candidate resources is characterized by different sort of performance assumptions. So we said earlier on that, you know, wind and solar and geothermal all have a different profile. Storage technologies have different operating constraints. Gas technologies have different operating constraints. And all of that sort of feeds into the ultimate economics of what gets sort of selected in each sort of time horizon that the model's looking at. Next slide. This is the last slide on the inputs and assumptions. It's meant to highlight the final key distinguishing factor between scenarios 1, 2, and 3, which is the assumption of export limits from the CAISO, which is to say that our current practice case is really designed around a world in which we're somewhat restricted in our ability to export power because of the bilateral friction that exists today. And so in this case, exports have been limited to 2,000 megawatts in scenario 1. And then scenarios 2 and 3 relax that quantity, assuming basically the centralized operations to an 8,000 megawatt limit. So I think in the interest of time, I'm actually going to kind of power through the rest of the presentation again fairly quickly, and then we'll spend the remaining time on questions that you all have, and we may be able to stick around a little bit extra if there is interest in doing so. So the transition is now into the results that came out of the modeling that we did in SB 350. What I wanted to say right up front is just to characterize the types of inputs that Resolve makes available. This is kind of a short inventory of the things that we can pull out of Resolve. The two focal points of the SB 350 work were the incremental portfolio of resources, basically the installed capacity of all of the stuff that Resolve selects, and then how much all of that stuff costs, which ultimately went into the ratepayer impact calculation. Now, of course, there are many more things that we can pull out of Resolve than just these two metrics that I think will be useful in the context of integrated resource planning. These are listed here, but in addition to these metrics, as you'll see, we can also actually show the simulation of operations for all of the days that were modeled and kind of give a sense of how the system is actually operating in response to the new investments that are being put onto the system. Next slide. So the next sort of series of slides is meant to highlight essentially the resources that were selected by Resolve as the incremental resources to make up the optimal portfolio. So what you'll see is basically a sequence of tables with scenarios 1A, 1B, 2, and 3, and then all of the different resources that, that make up those portfolios represented each as a row. What you're seeing here is the energy that was selected from each of these candidate resources in gigawatt hours. And I won't go through this table in too much depth, except to highlight an interesting metric that we have at the bottom here, which is renewable curtailment. This is kind of a key impact that, that we found in the regionalization study, which is as we move from sort of current practices and the inflexibility of the bilateral world that we exist in today towards a more regionally operated grid, what you can see is that renewable curtailment is actually decreasing over time across those scenarios. And that actually requires us to essentially overbuild the generation fleet a little bit less in each of those scenarios. So next slide. So these, I think, are a little bit more intuitive as far as sort of comparing how different scenarios impact the resource build-out over time. And I'll try to kind of highlight the key impacts that we see as we move through each of these scenarios. This particular slide is focused on scenario one, and in scenario one, we actually kind of have two flavors of that scenario, one with a 2,000 megawatt export limit, another with an 8,000 megawatt export limit. I said up front that basically the changes in grid economics that accompany regionalization can actually influence what's selected in the portfolio, and you can begin to see that effect taking place here. Essentially, as we relax that constraint from 2,000 to 8,000, what you can see is a shift in the California portfolio towards a solar PV resource. Essentially, the more we can export, the more economic it becomes to actually build additional solar PV. So you can see that between scenarios 1A and 1B, we see an increase in solar in California from 76 gigawatts up to 83 gigawatts. And that's actually offsetting, in this case, I believe, some of the out-of-state wind resources that had previously been selected. It's also worth noting that scenario 1A actually does select some storage economically. So, you know, the way of thinking about this or interpreting this is that, you know, the solar build that we were seeing in scenario 1A was essentially high enough that there was enough sort of curtailment, periods of curtailment, that it was actually economic for the model to select storage as part of the optimal portfolio to help it essentially deal with some of the overgeneration challenges that we've discussed previously. Next slide. So what you see here is a comparison between 1A and scenario 2. The impacts that we see here are somewhat similar to the comparison between 1A and 1B. Essentially, opening up the export constraint has the first level impact of reducing curtailment within the CAISO, but then notably it also does result in some shift in the optimal renewable build-out as well. So we do see a little bit more solar showing up in scenario 2 than we did in scenario 1A. And then you can see actually that we built quite a bit less of the California wind in scenario 2 than in scenario 1. This is actually kind of the manifestation of the reduction in overbuild. We just don't have to build out quite as much renewable generation because we have less curtailment in scenario 2. Next slide. And this slide compares 1A with scenario 3. The big effects to sort of highlight here are the shift from in-state resources to out-of-state. We see quite a bit more out-of-state, close to 4,000 megawatts of New Mexico and Wyoming wind selected in scenario 3. And that's displacing a combination of in-state solar and in-state wind. So I guess, you know, stepping back, I think what we'd like you guys to think about or to recognize here is, once again, not necessarily the specifics of these particular scenarios and the merits of these particular scenarios, but to kind of start thinking about or trying to process how Resolve can be used, essentially, to sort of define different potential futures and then sort of chart the optimal portfolio that you might see in those different futures. Next slide. I did want to provide everyone with at least one snapshot of the operational model that we have within Resolve. So what you're seeing here is a sample day, the same day, in scenarios 1A and scenario 3. And you can see kind of a stark difference in operations on this particular day. In scenario 1, this is a day where we actually had quite a bit of middle-of-the-day curtailment due to the high quantity of solar PV. You can also see in that scenario 1A that we do have a decent amount of storage kind of absorbing some of that overgeneration in the middle of the day and using it to meet load in the off-peak periods. Scenario 3, excuse me, obviously looks quite a bit different. In fact, we're able to operate on this day without any renewable curtailment throughout the day. That's a result of two main factors here. One is the fact that the portfolio actually looks a little bit different and is less solar heavy, but the second being that you can see that we're actually exporting quite a bit in the middle of the day up towards that 8,000 megawatt limit, and that's shown by the difference between the solid line, solid black line, and the dotted black line in scenario 3. Next slide. We've got just a couple more before wrapping up. I did want to point out sort of the key metric that came out of the work that we did with Resolve in the regionalization study, which is the total fixed cost associated with each one of these portfolios. So the key takeaway on this slide, without emphasizing the specific results of the regionalization study, is that each portfolio that's produced by Resolve has essentially an estimate of the total fixed cost of all of the generation resources that were selected for inclusion within that portfolio. And of course, what we're not showing here is the operational cost, which of course is another component of the objective function that can be extracted from Resolve. Next slide. We've talked about shadow prices a couple times throughout this call, and we've definitely heard some interest from parties in sort of being able to look at those types of diagnostics to understand what the model is doing. I wanted to show this as just one example of a shadow cost that comes out of Resolve, which is the marginal cost of RPS compliance from the regionalization study. And you can see that shown as three lines in the chart on the right, three lines that are increasing over time, which reflects the fact that marginal compliance with the RPS, the marginal cost of compliance with the RPS is increasing over time. The interesting dynamic that you see here is that the marginal cost of complying with the RPS is actually highest in scenario 1, and that's generally reflective of the fact that in that scenario, renewable curtailment is sort of such a frequent phenomenon that even as you're continuing to build additional renewables on top of the system, some of those marginal renewable resources will be curtailed, and there's some cost associated with that as well. And my next slide, which I believe is the last, once again, something that is worth thinking about in the context of IRP, for the SB 350 regionalization work, we did look at essentially a lot of sensitivities and try to quantify how different uncertainties in the future would impact the various scenarios that we looked at. Within the SB 350 regionalization study, we took the approach of essentially varying each of these parameters one at a time to sort of study how they influence the optimal portfolio and optimal cost. But just kind of glancing at this table, you can get a sense of the types of levers that we pulled to study sensitivities within the regionalization study. So that was maybe a bit of a whirlwind through that section. We did want to try to make it through the whole thing, but we have some time now for questions, and I imagine we'll be kind of referring back to a lot of the material that we kind of just breezed through. So,
and just a reminder, if you want to enter the Q&A queue, use *6 to add yourself, and we'll move through the questioners one by one. Thank you.
Hi, this is Kevin Woodruff again. A trip down memory lane for me. Question, I think before you went through this section, I think it was Jan Reed asked about sort of the assumptions used in SB 350 compared to those that will be used for the IRP study. I just want to be clear. This is what you developed for the SB 350 study. You're not presupposing that any of this is going to be appropriate for the IRP. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, this is Arnie. I think that's just generally right, Kevin. I mean, you know, things like the renewable supply availability in California, those came from the RPS calculator, so you know that's a good starting point to develop the IRP scenarios. But there's a number of assumptions that were, you know, again, very specific to the question of, you know, what are the impacts of expanding the operational footprint of the ISO that, you know, may or may not be appropriate for answering a different question, which is, you know, what is the optimal portfolio of renewable resources and solutions for the ISO?
Okay, I just wanted to be clear. There was no real. We haven't really discussed those kinds of issues yet.
Yeah, there'll be a separate group that discusses those, and I think all this stuff will be on the table.
Okay, very good. Just wanted to be clear on that. Thanks.
Yep.
Yeah, and just to add briefly to that, this is Forrest. If you go back to like the third slide, we tried to lay out the different work paths that Energy Division staff is engaged in. And the third box is the assumptions development process. So we are currently compiling that list, and that will be there will be an opportunity for feedback from parties on our thinking along those lines.
All right, great. Thank you.
Hi, this is Carrie Bentley, consultant to ARM. I have a few questions. First, I'm trying to translate the terms used in this presentation with the terms used previously, and I was wondering if I have this correct. So can I relate the base assumptions to the uncertainty factors, and then can I relate the scenarios to the candidate acquisition plans? Or if that's not right, can you translate it for me?
Forrest, do you want to take that one?
Okay, so so you're referring to, just to be clear, referring to the terminology that was developed in the last webinar, which was the scenario development series of webinars. And here we're talking about, we haven't maybe done the perfect job at going back through this particular presentation and making sure, in particular, that I think the word scenario is one of the more challenging ones to kind of nail down a precise definition of, and it maybe not used in exactly the same way. But here, what I'm seeing is you have each one of these. So this is the, what Nick described here on slide 43 is something like the hub and spoke model that was presented in the scenario development deck. And so you have certain base assumptions that are in that central sphere, and then you're going to be varying those in one by one in each of the spokes that come out of that central circle.
So those are those uncertainty factors then in the scenario language or the scenario development model language?
Yeah, I mean, typically we think of them as uncertainties. I say typically, and I think actually I'm going to defer. I think we're envisioning sort of this conversation happening maybe in the very next webinar, where we're kind of bringing all this together and trying to come up with a proposal for, you know, the IRP specific context. So I don't want to get too far down this road because I think in general that's true. But it becomes a little bit tricky, and in some cases where you're talking about something that might be under the influence of PUC or of the CPUC or of the LOCs that fall under our IRP jurisdiction. So things like, high rooftop PV, I mean, in theory, that's something that the PUC may have, the CPUC may have some influence over. And so the way we were defining it in the scenario development context was that, typically things that are under CPUC influence are sort of different acquisition plans. But But I think I also noted in that presentation that, you know, in certain circumstances, depending on the capabilities of the model and available data, then we might represent those as uncertainties instead. So, but I think we'll explore this in more detail and try to put a finer point on this in the next webinar.
Okay, that's helpful. So a couple more quick questions. In this, it talked about using data from RPS 6.1. Are you guys going to update that to use 6.2 data?
Yeah, and in fact, we have a new set of data that would be going into RPS Calculator 6.3 that we think might be appropriate for use in IRP. So that'll be part of the full assumptions proposal that we'll be sending out for feedback in the near future.
Okay, great. And then last question, I didn't entirely follow the discussion on unit commitment. I understand that you said that you could restrict plant operations to be above PMIN, but I wasn't sure whether you could restrict it from not turning on and turning off every hour. Is that something you parameterized, or can, you know, a thermal unit in 1 hour turn on and then the next hour turn off and then the next hour turn on again?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in a mixed integer program, that's something that you would model typically as like a minimum uptime and a minimum downtime, and you'd say, you know, a certain plant has to be essentially online for a minimum of 8 hours and, you know, has to stay offline for a minimum of 8 hours maybe. We have built some logic into Resolve to try to capture that. That is a difficult type of sort of dynamic to model within a linear program. And so once again, it's kind of a simplified representation of that type of phenomenon, but it is represented in a simplified way.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
We have six more callers in the queue. I just want to ask people to try to, you know, narrow down on your most important questions so we can try to get through as many as we can before the half an hour mark.
Hi, this is Aaron Burdick from PG&E. I had two questions. One was related to earlier you mentioned that you'll be making the data sources that you plan to use to update the candidate resources in Resolve available. I was wondering if you could perhaps give an indication of when we might expect those. I think some of the supply side and the RPS data may be familiar to stakeholders, but some of the demand side information that you'll be adding may benefit from additional time for review. And then the second question was related to what aspects of the RPS calculator may kind of transition into Resolve. Just was curious kind of how you're modeling the RPS requirement, if it is for the system versus LSEs, whether it includes bank usage, and then I also wanted to ask about the transmission constraints and whether you see Resolve replacing kind of the transmission planning function related to energy only and fully deliverable resources that was being developed in the RPS calculator.
Okay, so let me take the assumptions one first. We don't have a good estimate yet. I think definitely in the next, before the end of the year, we'll have an assumptions proposal, and we're definitely diligently working on that, working with other sections here within Energy Division and across agencies with the Energy Commission and the California Independent System Operator, as well as ARB, to pull that together. So it's there's a lot of different threads that need to be drawn into one document. So we're diligently working on that, and I unfortunately don't have a more specific date for that release yet. As the RPS calculator, I think you mentioned a couple of the key assumptions that we would be looking to build on. So contractual information, definitely looking at pulling that in, as well as resource cost and potential information that was developed for the RPS calculator. Those are the some of the key ones. But I'll let E3 respond to any of the other functional considerations regarding the way that the RPS calculator worked and how it translates to Resolve.
Thanks, Horace. So there's definitely a lot of data
that we'll be leveraging from the RPS calculator as far as contracts and potential, et cetera, as Forrest said. That said, Resolve is, it's not going to have sort of the LSE-specific detail that the RPS calculator was eventually built out to include in version 6.0 and beyond. Resolve is intended to be sort of a system-level optimization, and because of that, you know, it's essentially optimizing a renewable portfolio for an entire zone at once, not for sort of individual utilities. So all of the sort of information that we had included in the RPS calculator that was really LSE-specific, that's not really a level of detail that we'll be carrying forward into Resolve. When it comes to deliverability and energy only, I had said earlier on that the planning reserve margin logic is one of the areas of functionality that we're essentially interested in doing some development on in the next couple months. And that question of the best way to capture the dynamics between energy-only and fully deliverable resources and their, you know, different impacts on the system will be part of that development task.
Thanks. That's very helpful. Can you just clarify whether Resolve includes representation of the RPS bank?
Oh, right. Yes, we have built out functionality to allow essentially the banking and then later redemption of that bank to defer procurement obligations.
Thanks very much.
Hi, this is Paul Klapka from Southern California Edison. A process question for Energy Division. Right now, I mean, it's worthwhile to work through all this stuff on an informal basis. At what point will the process become formal? Will that be when you issue your December report, and will it come out as an ACR, or have you, or do you know when that's going to happen?
So it's true that when the Energy Division finalizes its proposal, the intention is that would be entered into the record of the proceeding and would be available for formal comment. And I think the scoping memo currently calls for that to happen in December. And many parties and Energy Division staff acknowledge some of the time challenges involved in that, but that is the current plan.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all set. You can go to the next question.
This is Dario Shuma. I'm with the California Wind Energy Association. The question I have is related to this limit, that somewhat arbitrary limit of 2,000 megawatt export limit or 8,000 megawatt export limit. Did you ever try to, rather than doing that, put in the actual limits that are out there? By the way, there is no transmission transfer capability limit. It is all, if there is anything, is CAISO's high wheeling rate. I mean, without regionalization, that wheeling rate will apply, and after regionalization, it won't apply. Have you tried to perform the study with simply that hurdle rate and see whether you get reasonable results out of it?
I mean, Darius, one of the challenges of that is that there isn't even really a WECC path rating west to east across the west of River Path, and there certainly is nothing like the simultaneous import limit that the ISO and the CEC have been using in their studies for years.
Yeah.
So if you were to add up just the capacity of every circuit that connects California to the rest of the West, you'd get something like 21 or something thousand megawatts of export capability. We know it can't ever get to near that much, but there's not really been studies done to tell us exactly how much that might be.
Yeah.
And I think the notion in the ISO study is that long before you ever got to that limit, you'd get to the limit of each of the other BAs to be able to accept the surplus, variable null power from California, while still meeting all of their balancing obligations as BAAs, you know, under NERC control performance standards. So, you know, in the judgment of the study team, 8,000 was the maximum that you could ever expect to get, even under regionalization. But, you know, we're recognizing that there's not a lot of detailed study behind that, even that number.
I can say that even 8,000 megawatt maybe arbitrary because, well, it is arbitrary, but I don't think there is any reason for any export limit. I mean, export limit, the problem is always bringing power into California. There have never been problems getting power out of California unless you sort of you exceed a particular particular path rating, if it exists, east, west to east, which doesn't, by and large doesn't, and the specific lines that are involved. So in that, but I think, as you say, what will stand in the way is, first of all, the hurdle rate of 18 to 20 bucks per megawatt hour. I think that's where the numbers may already be, if not going there. And also the fact that, out-of-state utilities out-of-state will have their own RPS resources. They will have their own ability to absorb our resources to a great extent. I just don't see the need to have these artificial limits, as I don't think they correspond to reality. And I don't think there's a need for that either.
Well, I guess I would just, one quick response to that before we move on to the next question, which is that, that's a very complex question, obviously, how much of this surplus generation could be absorbed by each of the other 37 BAs. To try to answer it at all would require, I think, a lot more resolution, a lot more granularity than we have in the resolve model. If you just assume everything is linear and it's all a big infinite bus, then you're right, there wouldn't be any need for any export limit at all. I think, to me, that'd be unrealistic. So there is a need for some level of export limit, just based on reality and based on the notion that we haven't, this is uncharted territory. We don't really know what it looks like there. What that limit is,
If you get to a 50,000 megawatt number, you may want to worry about it, but I don't think you're going to get even close to 8,000 megawatt.
Okay, and we'll look forward to your comments on that when we get to
sure.
the point of actually finalizing the assumptions we'll really use. So thank you, Dariush.
Absolutely.
We have one last question in the queue.
Hi, Kevin Woodruff again, and Dariush. I just have a quick question. Sort of that Dariush prompted in my mind, which is, does Resolve have the ability to test the ability of other WECC utilities to absorb renewable generation from California? Or is that sort of level of detail beyond how Resolve has been built to this point?
Yeah, Kevin, that's exactly what we've been using this export constraint as a proxy for.
Okay.
There may be other ways to attack the problem. If you had, for example, very much higher minimum generation levels in the Northwest or the Southwest, if you had must-run status on some of their coal units to reflect the way that they really operate them, those might be other ways to get at that same issue. But, again, just given the resolution of the non-CalISO geography and resolve, the export limit seemed like just the easiest and really, most transparent way to express the idea that this constraint exists.
And
right, okay.
I'll
now,
just add to that, Kevin, very quickly that, this isn't a challenge that's actually unique to resolve.
Right.
More traditional and much more complicated production cost models actually face the same challenge. And because of that, in past LTPP cycles, for example, the CalISO has played around with export limits in those cases as well to generally reflect the same dynamics that Arnie was talking about. So this is not a resolve-specific challenge.
Yeah, my sense, I understand how with, WECC-wide production cost models, you could, in theory, do this. My sense is resolve is much less detailed. So I was just exploring whether there was a sort of another way to do that. It sounds like there probably isn't. Anyway, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, everyone. This ends the second webinar. We'll have another webinar at the same time next week.
on scenario development, and the following week will be our third webinar in this modeling advisory group series. So look forward to hearing from you then.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.